within, or the respect within the country. She's a very nice woman, but she doesn't have the respect.
I think many people were shocked that President Trump threw Maria Corina Machado under the bus, the woman who basically dedicated her Peace Prize and said that Trump should have gotten that Peace Prize. Where does this leave her? And also talk about the wife of exactly who President Maduro's wife, Celia Flores, is. She is a key political figure herself.
For sure. I mean, let's start with Maria Corina Machado.
And we have 30 seconds.
No one could have been more surprised as she was sidelined, not just at the press conference, but then doubled down yesterday. Marco Rubio also saying that she's not ready, you know, to stand in. I think what Machado overestimated was the degree to which Trump wanted democracy. He doesn't want democracy. He just wants oil, right? And so in that sense, you know, it was unsurprising that she would be sidelined to anyone but her.
Celia Flores, 10 seconds.
Celia Flores, you know, long story career under Chavez, was the head of the National Assembly, you know, significant degree of political power. We'll see what emerges from this trial.
And we're going to talk more about this in these coming days. And also remember that President Trump just pardoned the convicted narco-trafficker, Honduran President Juan Orlando Hernandez. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.
KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communication Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. This month's Development and Events Committee meeting will be held on Monday, January 12th at 5 p.m. The meeting will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland and online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting virtually can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
KBOO's Zine, The Boo Beat, is back with a second issue featuring KBOO's program guide, interviews with local activists and community members, spotlights on local businesses, on-the-ground reporting, and fun quizzes and crosswords. Our zine has its finger on the pulse of Portland, and you won't want to miss it. To snag your copy, visit kboo.fm/zine.
Support for KBOO comes from its members and from Rumble on the River, presenting their 28th community forum, What's the Deal with Data Centers, on Wednesday, January 7th at 825 Northwest 18th Avenue. Doors and info tables at 5:30 p.m. and community panel at 6:30 p.m. More info available at 350pdx.org/event.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up in the KBOO Evening News, hundreds of Portlanders protest Trump's invasion of Venezuela.
Oregon stores can now scan everyone's ID when buying age-restricted items, no matter how old they seem.
And in national news, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting votes to dissolve itself after losing federal funding.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, January 5th, 2026. I'm Terrence Burns.
And I'm Dave Johnson. Over the weekend, several hundred Portlanders turned out to protest downtown against the Trump administration's kidnapping of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro. Trump rationalized the kidnapping by saying Maduro's election was illegitimate and abetted drug trafficking or narco-terrorism in the U.S. At one rally, Luis Martinez with the Portland Democratic Socialist of America said in a speech, quote, "Narco-terrorism is the new weapons of mass destruction. What happened is completely illegal, wildly illegal," end quote. Martinez isn't the only activist to liken kidnapping of Maduro to the U.S. war in Iraq. Portland City Councilors Mitch Green and Annalita Murillo voiced their condemnation online. Green wrote on Blue Sky, quote, "Waking up to the news that the U.S. has bombed Venezuela, kidnapped its president, and will now seek to decide its fate, i.e. liberate its natural resources. We don't have the money for basic infrastructure in our local communities, but we can always start new wars. Absolutely sickening," end quote. Indivisible Beaverton planned a hands-off Venezuela rally this afternoon. They're calling on Oregon's congressional delegation to push for a Senate vote requiring congressional authorization for any further actions against Venezuela.
Shortly after the illegal attack on Venezuela and the kidnapping of its president, Donald Trump again discussed an American takeover of the Danish territory of Greenland and threatened military action in Colombia. He says taking over Greenland is needed for U.S. security interests, and Colombia may be attacked for facilitating the global sale of cocaine. Meanwhile, Secretary of State Marco Rubio said, "Communist government in Cuba is, quote, in a lot of trouble. Leaders and residents of other countries are now asking who's next." Trump has referred to the Monroe Doctrine, which rejects European colonialism, and the Roosevelt Corollary, a justification invoked by the U.S. in supporting Panama's secession from Colombia, which ultimately helped secure the Panama Canal Zone for the U.S. Trump has even joked the former document is now being called the Monroe Doctrine. Denmark has jurisdiction over the vast mineral-rich island of Greenland. The Danish Prime Minister, Mette Frederiksen, told Trump to stop threatening Greenland, adding he has no right to annex the country. Denmark already provides the United States broad access to Greenland through existing security agreements. Denmark also just signed on to a European Union statement underscoring that, quote, the right of the Venezuelan people to determine their future must be respected, end quote. Asked whether he might order the U.S. to conduct a military operation against Colombia, Trump replied, quote, it sounds good to me.
A new law requiring Medicare to identify high-cost drugs and negotiate with drug companies to lower prices will lead to lower prices for 10 popular prescription drugs starting this year. Many popular drugs for things like diabetes and heart failure will be 50% cheaper on average for most people on Medicare, including some 900,000 Oregonians. Isabel Charlet has more on this story.
10 popular medications used largely by older adults will be an average of 50% cheaper for most of Oregon's Medicare enrollees starting this year. The change is a result of a new law that was part of the Inflation Reduction Act passed in 2022. It requires Medicare to negotiate with pharmaceutical companies for lower prices for common, high-cost prescription drugs. Stacy Larson with AARP Oregon says the new law will benefit many of the state's nearly 940,000 Medicare beneficiaries.
There are seniors who face very, very high out-of-pocket costs and often have to choose between utilities or their prescription drugs. And that situation is untenable. Fortunately, some relief is in sight.
This first round of price cuts includes drugs that treat conditions such as diabetes, heart failure, chronic kidney disease, arthritis, and blood clot prevention. A second set of 15 medications is on the bargaining table right now with a plan to debut more lower prices in 2027. The medications in this first round are used by nearly 9 million Medicare enrollees nationwide, and the changes are estimated to translate into $1.5 billion in out-of-pocket savings this year alone. Larson explains, though this is a victory, the fight for lower drug costs isn't over, and she predicts future negotiations will not be easy.
Big drug companies are spending millions of dollars to delay negotiations and keep prices high. And AARP Oregon will be fighting for older Oregonians every step of the way.
The law also caps insulin at $35 per month for people enrolled in Medicare, makes vaccines free for conditions like shingles, and requires rebates when companies raise prices faster than inflation. For Public News Service, I'm Isabel Charlet.
More people are applying to medical school compared with years past, according to a new report. But with Oregon's healthcare worker shortage demanding nearly 225,000 new workers by 2035, higher enrollment rates are not all that's needed to meet the growing demand. KABU reporter Lizard has more.
National medical school enrollment surpassed 100,000 for the first time this year, a milestone following a 3-year decline in applicants. This comes as many states, including Oregon, face a significant healthcare shortage. The Oregon Employment Department reports that the state will need nearly 225,000 new healthcare workers over the next decade to meet growing demand. Rob Cloutier, assistant dean for admissions at Oregon Health and Science University, notes that after an uptick in applicants during the pandemic, followed by a slight dip, application numbers are beginning to rise again.
We're going to need more doctors in the future than we have currently. So I think that this is a good way to start addressing a possible healthcare shortfall in terms of the physician workforce.
Cloutier explains that the challenge lies not in attracting applicants, but in the school's limited capacity to accept them. This year, the school received 7,300 applications, but can only admit 150 of them. Nationally, the Health Resources and Services Administration has forecast a shortage of nearly 700,000 physicians and nurses by 2037. Experts attribute the shortage to an aging population's rising demand, higher rates of retirement, and challenges in retaining workers due to burnout. Cloutier says any policy solutions to the problem need to be multifaceted.
I grow increasingly humbled by what it will take to fix the healthcare system right now, because it's just a very complicated problem, but it's one that nonetheless we are going to have to figure out.
The report also found that more women entered medical school than men for the 7th consecutive year, although male applicants have been catching up for the past several years. For KABU News and the Oregon News Service, I'm Lizard.
Lincoln County Commission Chair Claire Hall passed away Sunday after a brief illness at the age of 66. A special recall election against her, scheduled for Friday, is basically void, according to county elections officials. It was the first recall election in Lincoln County history. Hall was a commissioner for 21 years, with a reputation for advocating for unhoused people and affordable housing. She publicly came out as transgender in 2018 while in office. But the past 15 months in the role of chair were fraught with chaotic meetings, clashes with other commissioners. Some department heads helped put on the recall effort. David Elton of Glen Eden Beach formed a political action committee spending more than $40,000 against Hall in the recall election. Elton told the Lincoln Chronicle, quote, "Hall was a ferocious fighter for the homeless, for warming shelters and helping the downtrodden. The little guy struggling to survive. Nobody worked harder than Hall on affordable housing. I'm shocked and saddened by this death," end quote. Prior to her role on the county commission, Hall was a journalist reporting for the Newport News Times and other coast radio stations. As commissioner, she served on local, state, and national boards for homeless and housing issues, on the Governor's Council on Alcohol and Drug Programs, and the Oregon Ending Homelessness Advisory Council. Election officials in Lincoln County say they're trying to determine if they legally still need to count the recall ballots that have already been cast.
Oregon businesses that sell age-restricted items like alcohol or cannabis can scan everyone's driver's license or ID thanks to a new law that took effect on January 1st. Prior to this law change, businesses could only scan IDs if there was reasonable doubt about someone's age, in this case meaning they look younger than 26. That law got Plaid Pantry and other convenience stores in hot water, facing class action lawsuits because of their universal scanning policies. Instead of complying with the law, they lobbied to change it in last year's session. The law says that retailers can't store your information, but in reality, it's hard to know how or what amount of your data might be stored. That worried privacy advocates who spoke out against the bill while it was in the state house. Still, the law passed both houses with wide margins, supported by both Republicans and Democrats. There are still businesses that can check IDs manually, not by scanning or using third-party company. Buyers are advised to look into the privacy policies of the business who swipe their IDs and watch out for unusual activity. If businesses violate the law, people can sue for damages up to $5,000.
Americans react to military operations in oil-rich Venezuela and wonder what comes next. Maryland prepares for a political battle over redistricting, and the now former New York City mayor vetoes a bill designed to lower rents. With that story and more, it's Zamon Paris with 2026 Talks.
Welcome to 2025 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
It wasn't necessary because this is not an invasion. We didn't occupy a country. This was an arrest operation. This was a law enforcement operation. He was arrested on the ground in Venezuela by FBI agents, read his rights, and removed from the country.
Secretary of State Marco Rubio is defending the legality of the military operation that brought Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro to the U.S. Without congressional notification, special operations forces captured the unpopular dictator at a Caracas safe house. Aircraft hit sites around the city, killing more than 40. The U.S. had previously moved a huge force of warships into the Caribbean and struck nearly three dozen boats, killing more than 100. President Donald Trump justified that as targeting drug smuggling, but says the U.S. will now, quote, run Venezuela. He says American oil companies will take over and revitalize the country's big but ailing petroleum industry. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer says the operation broke U.S. and international law and clearly violated the Constitution.
They did not just do ships off the water. They went inside Venezuela, bombed civilian as well as military places. And it's a violation of the law to do what they did without getting the authorization of Congress.
Maduro's vice president has taken power with the support of the nation's military. Venezuela, like much of Latin America, deeply resents U.S. intervention. Rubio says what happens there, including in the oil fields, will be dictated using the leverage of forces staying offshore rather than by troops sent in as an occupation. It is unclear if an unpopular and corrupt power structure left in place by Maduro's removal will resist. In other news, Maryland state lawmakers are preparing for a showdown over redistricting at this year's session. In response to the national gerrymandering arms race, Democratic Governor Wes Moore empowered a board to solicit new maps for the midterms. But some in the party criticize that as undemocratic. And Brenda Wintrode, politics reporter for the Baltimore Banner, says the state Senate majority leader knows the party lost a court case on redistricting in 2022.
He fears a court challenge could perhaps make things worse off for Democrats in Maryland. There are Republicans that are waiting in the wings for Democrats to do this. They have already lawyered up and they're ready to go.
A similar Republican effort stalled in the Indiana State Senate. New York City legislation aiming at helping renters was vetoed at the last minute by outgoing Mayor Eric Adams. The Community Opportunity to Purchase Act would have given nonprofits the first opportunity to buy certain multifamily buildings when a landlord sells. Elena Rodriguez with the New Economy Project says real estate companies are buying buildings and leaving affordable units empty.
New York City can't allow the actions of a lame duck mayor acting to appease powerful real estate interests to override the will of the city council and the communities it represents. This veto is not only an attack on urgently needed housing policy, it directly undermines the council's role as a democratic institution.
I'm Zamon Perez for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
You're listening to the KABU Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for a special rebroadcast of our interview with dance instructor Tony Carnell on the movement workshops they're offering to the public later this month. Then, Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertoff from the Global Citizen International Digest gives us a look back at 2025 in international news. At 6, it's Labor Radio. At 6:30, it's Prison Pipeline. Then at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with an overnight low of 37 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be rainy with a high of 45. Today in history, in 2024, An Alaska Airlines flight makes an emergency landing at the Portland airport after a door plug blows off the Boeing 737 MAX and into a Portlander's backyard. No one was killed, but the airplanes were grounded, and Boeing's design and manufacturing faced renewed scrutiny. The quote of the day is from Swiss author Friedrich Dürrenmatt, who wrote, quote, "Every state calls itself country or nation when it's about to commit murder. We nurtured a beast with our virtues. We became drunk on the greatness of our country, but what we loved has now turned into gall and wormwood."
A proposed EPA rule change could put 80% of U.S. wetlands at risk, and the public comment period ends today. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Monday is the deadline for the public to weigh in on a potential rule change by the EPA that could impact which water bodies may be protected from pollution. As KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazzo reports, tribes are among those asking for a 30-day extension to comment.
WOTUS, or the Waters of the United States, guides which resources fall under the Federal Clean Water Act. But as written, the EPA would narrow the law's enforcement, with estimates suggesting that 80% of the nation's wetlands could be at risk.
I think it's a big picture concern for everyone, really. Most tribes who want clean water or the ability to make sure that water is usable are probably going to write in opposition to kind of what the rule stands for.
Daniel Cordalis is Diné and runs the nonprofit Tribal Water Institute. While tribes can regulate waters on their reservations, they lack jurisdiction elsewhere.
Tribes can't look to the EPA anymore. I mean, arguably, federal governments have to protect these tribal resources, but who's going to do that?
Some states are stepping up, like Colorado, New Mexico, and Arizona.
That we're coordinating with our neighbors, tribes or states or country on our southern border to make sure that we each know what each other is doing.
Trevor Bagori is the Water Quality Division Director at the Arizona Department of Environmental Quality.
Hopefully this new rule will add some clarity as long as they are able to provide scientific tools to help us determine what's regulated and what's not.
For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Pietrazzo.
Attendance at a school near the Pine Ridge and Rosebud reservations has nearly doubled in the past 3 years. School leaders say they're engaging one-on-one with students and families. They're also implementing Lakota language and culture. South Dakota Searchlight's Megan O'Brien has more.
It'd be like a herd of horses coming in.
There you are! Where you been?
This is a typical morning at Norris Elementary, where most of the students are Native American. Principal Brian Brown greets students and staff at the cafeteria tables as breakfast is served. Brown also asks teachers who's missing. It's a way of getting ahead of the problem, he says. When students aren't at school, he makes phone calls and home visits. Just 3 years ago, barely half the students came to school regularly. Now, the school's attendance rate is above 90%. That's higher than the state average. It's a source of pride for Brown, who took over as principal in 2022.
I was very happy. I was very pleased. But more proud of the kids and the parents for their support and believing in Norris.
The leader of South Dakota's education department sees the success at Norris. The leadership and cultural engagement are important parts of that, Joseph Graves says.
And so now we want to see what kind of results this produces. We have the attendance, we have the drops in chronic absenteeism. Now we want to see what's going to happen with those proficiency rates and the graduation rates.
The school is on a gravel road about a half hour from other schools in the White River School District. Its isolation makes it difficult to hire and recruit teachers. In a small community, it takes everyone to keep students involved, Brown says. Some teachers have multiple grade levels in one classroom. The school's head custodian and office administrator are also bus drivers, and Brown steps in at lunchtime to help serve food. He also finds ways to make Lakota culture and language an important part of every student's day. Students sing every morning. Brown teaches Lakota studies to each grade once a week and started the school's first drum group, the Black Pipe Singers. For National Native News, I'm Megan O'Brien.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
The Corporation for Public Broadcasting has voted to dissolve itself after 58 years of service. The decision follows Congress taking back all of CPB's federal funding. Trump and allies have long criticized PBS and NPR, and plans to cut funding were outlined in Project 2025. Republican-controlled Congress would go on to cut $1.1 billion in funding from CPB, causing them to shut down in August. CPB's board determined that without the resources to fulfill its responsibilities, maintaining the corporation would not serve the public interest or advance the goals of public media. CPB was first authorized by Congress under the Public Broadcasting Act of 1967. The nonprofit allocated funds to NPR, PBS, and more than 1,500 other U.S. public radio stations, including KABU. President and CEO of CPB, Patricia Harrison, said, quote, "When the administration and Congress rescinded federal funding, our board faced a profound responsibility. CPB's final act would be to protect the integrity of public media system and the democratic values by dissolving, rather than allowing the organization to remain defunded and vulnerable to additional attacks," unquote. CPB will continue the distribution of all remaining funds in accordance with Congress's intent. Federal cuts inspired donors from across the country to go on a giving spree, sending $70 million in donations to public and community broadcasters over the last year. Ruby Calvert, chair of CPB's board of directors, said she is, quote, "convinced that public media will survive and that a new Congress will address public media's role in our country because it is critical to the children's education, our history, culture, and democracy to do so," unquote.
Cuts to child care funding in Washington Governor Bob Ferguson's proposed budget would further dismantle an already struggling industry, according to a coalition on child care advocacy organizations. The cuts would cap a program that helps low-income families affordable care and reduce the rates that providers get for serving each child. Isabel Charlet reports.
A coalition that supports Washington State's child care industry is sounding the alarm over proposed funding cuts in the governor's new budget. The group of 14 organizations says the reductions would dismantle support systems and push an already strained sector towards collapse. Governor Bob Ferguson's proposed budget would cut child care access for 14,000 low-income families by capping the Working Connections subsidy. Genevieve Stokes with Child Care Aware of Washington says the cuts would also reduce the rate that providers get for each child through the program.
That's a significant cut and is really going to force a lot of providers to stop serving children on subsidy or jack up the prices for their private pay parents who already are struggling to afford child care.
The proposed budget also cuts professional development funding for child care providers by 50%. Stokes says that would disproportionately affect women who dominate the field, hindering career advancement and lowering the quality of care. Stokes explains even without added cuts, the state economy loses $6 billion a year because the lack of child care forces parents to miss work, not take full-time positions, or refuse promotions. She emphasizes that whether someone has children in care or not, everyone depends on it.
Child care is how your nurses get to their jobs. It's how construction workers get to their building sites. It's how your farm workers are able to get onto the field.
Stokes adds cutting state funding would hit an industry already strained by federal cuts to Medicaid and other public service programs, as well as federal immigration policies. She says more than a quarter of early childhood educators are immigrants, and about 40% rely on some form of public assistance. She adds she supports state lawmakers who are looking to progressive revenue streams to generate more wealth for the state. For Public News Service, I'm Isabel Charlet.
New data shows hiring people who have served time after a criminal conviction, known as second chance hiring, can benefit both employers and communities. Experts say this kind of hiring can improve the lives of formerly incarcerated while helping employers with labor shortages. Nadia Ramlagan has more in West Virginia.
Employers in West Virginia and neighboring states continue to report trouble finding workers. New data show hiring people who have served their time after a criminal conviction, known as second chance hiring, can benefit both employers and communities. Talisa Carter with the Urban Institute says many people are released from prison without proper identification and face housing challenges. She says a focused resume can help level the playing field for candidates who are valuable to employers, but may not check all of the conventional boxes.
A resume that's skill-based really presents an opportunity for the formerly incarcerated to put their best foot forward in the workplace.
According to the Urban Institute, labor shortages are most common in the hospitality and retail trade industries. According to federal data, West Virginia had around 30,000 unemployed residents in 2024. Carter adds second chance hiring also has community benefits, as the vast majority of individuals currently incarcerated will eventually be released back into society.
Employment is one thing that studies repeatedly show promotes economic inclusion, but also reduces recidivism and strengthens families and neighborhoods.
According to the Vera Institute of Justice, people are less likely to reoffend and land back behind bars if they are able to maintain employment. This is Nadia Ramlagan for West Virginia News Service.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News from Monday, January 5th, 2026. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking stories and tips at 971-801-1378. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem, Carmel Pierre-Louis, Mel Gertoff, and Lizard. The producer and engineer is Althea Billings. Special thanks to Isabel Charlet, Antonio Gonzalez, Eric Tegethoff, Nadia Ramlagan, and Simone Perez. The director of the evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Terrence Burns.
And I'm Dave Johnson. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321.